Hey, I'm Dr. Z, and I'm a neurosurgeon. So that means long hours, early rounds, late nights, and everything in between. And through it all, I wear FIGS because they're built for what I do. Through the chaos, through the hours, and through whatever the day throws at me, they do their job so I can do mine. They're comfortable when it counts and functional when I need them the most. So where do you wear your FIGS? On shift, on call, on the couch in the break room, listening to this podcast, wherever it is, they fit right in. And now listeners of this podcast can get 15% off their first order. Just head to wearfigs.com and use code FIGSRX at checkout. That's wearfigs.com, code FIGSRX.
This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
A trigger warning before we begin. There is a mention of suicide in the episode.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's going on, Katie?
Sunday morning recording.
Oh, I love a Sunday morning recording session.
Right? It's nice. I mean, I guess it's 1 p.m. That's my bad. but it's nice. I'm excited. We're getting ahead. I hope we stay ahead. This is, look at us.
One could hope that we do. We'll see what happens.
Pete's being a problem. You know, the usual.
The usual.
I have nothing new to report because we just recorded the other day, but I'm sure I'm busy. I'm sure I'm good. I'm sure things are fine. So yeah, that's what I've got.
Nice. I want to give a little shout out to one of our listeners, one of our patrons. A shout out to Steph, who after... Yeah. The episode where I told you all about my divorce and shit, Steph reached out and asked if they could send me a care package. And I was like, oh my God, like, that's so nice. That's so, so nice sweet. That anyone would even like think to do that. I'm very much a person who does send care packages to people because I give a shit. So it's like, I don't know. It was just really nice that somebody else cared like that. It was so beautiful. And Steph has a shop called Creepy Kawaii.
Mm-hmm.
It was like all a bunch of stuff from their shop, and it was absolutely incredible. I'm obsessed with shop. The keychains. I immediately put all of the keychains onto my key ring, which is already the loudest key ring ever. Mm-hmm. Katie can attest to that.
It is.
Now it's even louder, and I'm obsessed. I really love the contemplating murder one with the crow.
That's such a good one.
Yes. And oh, this sweet baby stuffed Luna moth called Lydia, which I'm absolutely obsessed with. I want to read Lydia's story because it's adorable.
Lydia has a story.
Lydia has a story. Lydia, the Luna moth, represents the moon and brings comfort to those that are alone in the dark. She is in love with Lenore, the sun. The moon and the sun can't always be together, but for the special days they can, they make every moment count. And like, bitch, you're my Lenore. You're my Lenore, Katie.
I love you.
I love you.
But soon we will be together.
We will be together. So thank you so much, Steph. And everyone, go check out Steph's shop. Hold on, because I don't want to fuck up the name on Instagram. Let me pull it up, because I know it's not just Creepy Kawaii.
No, but they have these amazing holographic stickers of the Fresno Nightcrawler. I'm fucking obsessed, because I'm obsessed with the Fresno Nightcrawler. I love that they're just like walking little pants. Gabe and I are obsessed with them.
It's so cute. So their Instagram account is at @officialcreepykawaii. So definitely check it out, because their stuff is amazing. And thank you so much, Steph. Like, and your little note. Your handwritten note made me like tear up. I'm such an emotional bitch, and like, but things like that really hit me right in my fucking soul. Like, it's so beautiful. So thank you so much.
Yeah, it was gorgeous. Sorry, Pete is like, so he is like,
yeah,
all over me right
now. He is being a stage 5 clinger right now.
Yeah,
in like the most insane way. The way he just keeps trying to climb you, like.
Well, I was just like shooing him off of me. I was just muted saying, go, go, go. And he's here.
Oh my God, he's grasping onto you.
Yeah. He's my buddy.
The cats tried to murder me in my sleep when I was at the funeral home.
As cats do.
As cats do. I woke up to Chunk on my chest and, taking his paws and, trying to, put them on my face. And I was like, oh, okay, not cool.
We're not going to do that.
And then Monk, the other cat, when I woke up in the morning, Hercules was under the sheets with me and his face was covered by the sheets and I could only see his little paws. And Monk is on top of what would be his neck back area and one paw pushing the blankets on top of Herc's face. Mm-hmm. And I got a picture because I was like, oh, that's kind of funny. And then the second front paw pushed the blanket even more. And I went, okay, bitch, now you're trying to murder the dog while he's asleep. Oh, enough. Yeah.
The way that I have seen Pete murder his toys, drown his toys, is terrifying. I actually think there's something in his water bowl right now because he quite literally takes whatever he's playing with over to his water bowl and holds it under for a while.
Okay, he's drowning his toys.
He drowns his toys.
You said this was Pete?
Mm-hmm.
Pete is a murderous little boy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he's very antisocial. Yeah, he's my little serial killer.
Good to know. Good to know before I move in.
Serial killer. Here's the other thing, though. They've never scratched anyone.
Wow.
Ever.
Yeah, I don't. Or bitten anyone. They've never done that to me.
No.
Ever. Nope. I love them. I'm actually so excited to live around cats.
Yeah, they're the best.
So that's kind of. I don't really have an update. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Steph.
As Steph absolutely deserves. So yeah, I think we can jump right on in to our first episode for Black History Month.
Fantastic.
Last year, while telling the story of Magnus Hirschfeld, I mentioned how important the idea of intersectionality is when discussing everything. And when thinking about intersectionality, I always think of the brilliant author Audre Lorde. Poet, essayist, librarian, feminist, and equal rights activist, or a self-described, quote, Black lesbian, cancer survivor, mother warrior poet, end quote, whose work was often centered around discussing intersectionality and how you can't talk about one ism without the other. She was truly way ahead of her time and is still currently ahead of a lot of people in our time. You know, I love to do shit chronologically. All of our sources will be cited at the end. One of the great things about her is that not only was she an incredibly prolific writer, but she was surrounded by a lot of writers. So when you're trying to learn about her or what's going on, you can pretty much open up any biography of any Black poet at the time. And she, it's going to be like, oh, what's going on with Audre in this book? She's yes. All over the scene. There's so much, but a lot of this comes from various sources, including her autobiography, Zammy, Another Way to Spell My Name, which she does acknowledge is not 100% accurate. She calls it a little bit of a myth biography also because okay. She changes the names of a lot of people because they're still alive and they're gay in the early 1900s. So that doesn't
amazing
go great.
To not out them. That's fantastic. Yes.
And also in a little bit of an acknowledgement of her telling her side of the story is not the only side to the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I love her. She was born the third girl of her family, Audre with a Y, Geraldine Lorde, spelled Lorde, on February 18th, 1934 in New York City to immigrant parents from Grenada, which is an island nation in the Caribbean. They had moved there just 10 years before with the idea that they, Frederick and Linda, would move to the U.S., work for a little while and save up their money, and then they would move back home with an American dream-sized bank account. Unfortunately, that remained a dream, as getting work as a Black man and an immigrant was incredibly difficult. Linda was able to get a job working as a maid at the Waldorf Hotel, but in order to do so, she had to pass as white, and her employer assumed that she was Spanish, so she just sort of never corrected them. One day, Linda got really sick and couldn't pick up her paycheck that they desperately needed, so Frederick went to pick it up, and once the Waldorf Hotel saw that she was married to a Black man, they immediately fired Linda. Frederick started studying real estate, which would eventually lead to a real estate business. They had the first of their three daughters in 1929, the next in 1931, and then Audrey. They moved to Harlem during the Harlem Renaissance, making it an incredibly inspiring and creative area to grow up in. Audrey grew up so nearsighted that she was legally blind. And on top of that, she didn't start speaking until she was four and learned to read and write kind of like all at the same time. Mm-hmm. As speaking. And once she started speaking, she spoke with a stutter. She was incredibly intelligent and determined, but she was a hellion, as she will get to later. Because she was so smart, she was bored in class. So she found herself getting into trouble.
Can relate.
I mean, nowhere near as smart as her, but like,
oh, yeah.
But it was, what's up?
School was a struggle because I was bored because I was...
So at a certain point, like, she would come home and she like get in trouble, and then she would tell her mom, and her mom would go to the school and be like, all right, so what are you guys gonna do to like help keep her, you know, learning shit? Because if you guys can't keep this together, we're going to put her in a different school.
Yeah. If you can't keep her engaged and teach her in a way that is going to be satisfactory, like,
yeah,
fuck you.
Yes. It didn't work out. So her parents took her out of that school and enrolled her in a different elementary school when she was 11. The way that Audrey speaks of it, she says, quote, I went to Catholic schools, you see, and smartness was not as important as being good. And I was really bad, end quote. There's a great documentary, A Litany of Survival, about her life that you see a lot of interviews with her. And that's, she kind of talks about, like, she would find herself in trouble and just like causing shenanigans. Her sisters would, like, she would write in the book when she wasn't supposed to, or when she was supposed to, she would write in the wrong spot. Like, well, they were also in, it was Catholic school. It's like very strict.
That's when they used to beat kids too in Catholic schools.
Yes, it is. At one point, Audrey even said in the documentary, she's like, they wrote a note home to my mom that said, like, please stop sending her to school in such thick clothing because she can't feel the punishments.
Oh my
God. But Audrey was like, she wasn't like traumatized by it. She was just very like, haha, gotcha. She's very like, she owns her shit. She's in charge.
Not them being like, please make it easier for us to abuse your child. What?
Dude, it's their early 30s. Mm. Early 30s and 40s. And you know, the parents were probably like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's what parents.
Sure.
It's what happened then. They moved to a different area where they were the only Black family on the block, which meant that she was the only Black kid in school. Mm. And that was incredibly difficult, where we can all imagine that she experienced a lot of racism. From an early age, Audrey always loved poetry. She commented in Black Women Writers, quote, I used to speak in poetry. I would read poems and I would memorize them. People would say, well, what do you think, Audrey? What happened to you yesterday? And I would recite a poem, and somewhere in that poem would be a line or a feeling that I would be sharing. In other words, I literally communicated through poetry. And when I couldn't find the poems to express the things I was feeling, that's when I started writing poetry. And that's when I was like 12 or 13, end quote. So that was how, from forever, she's always found a way. She's always expressed herself through poetry, which is just so amazing and beautiful.
It's like magical.
Right?
It's just amazing to think about how some people's brains function like that.
Mm-hmm. Audrey wanted to attend the publicly funded but required like admission Hunter High School, which everywhere I read said was like very prestigious at the time. So she had to test into this school where she was only one of three Black students, but she didn't feel alone the way that she did at other schools. Audrey herself, as well as her sisters and friends, referred to this feeling stemming from the fact that a lot of the other students also came from working class families. And while not a lot of them were Black, they were also ethnic minorities. Mm-hmm. So she wasn't feeling lost or alone the way she had been in previous schools. She really starts building a community for herself within this school. In the documentary, Audrey says that when she wrote her first poem, she was, quote, introverted, hypersensitive, too intense, all of the words for little wild Black girls who were too determined to live, end quote.
Damn, too determined to live.
Right?
Fuck.
And that's just how she talks, just like chit-chatting with stuff, like with her friends. Like, she's so fucking brilliant.
It's beautiful.
I highly recommend everyone reads her autobiography. Actually, you should read her autobiography right now, because it goes up until her 20s, maybe her 30s. Mm-hmm. And it's just about being like wildly gay and lost is how a podcast described it. And I couldn't put into words that was the perfect, clear as fact, described it as wildly, like her being wildly gay and lost. And I was like, yeah, yes.
That's me right now.
That's you right now.
In my 30s.
Just you're going to see a lot of yourself in Audrey.
Cool.
At a certain point in her life, like when she was like writing and stuff, Audrey really liked the idea of her first name and last name both ending in E's. So she just dropped the Y. So now it's A-U-D-R-E and Lord, L-O-R-D-E.
You know what? That is very satisfying to the brain.
It is.
Like, truly. I'm like, the neurodivergency is screaming.
I get it. She wrote a sonnet for class and it was rejected. And she was like, fuck this. This is actually amazing and I know it. She submitted it to Seven Magazine and they published it, earning a ton of money from the publishing of that poem, and it becoming her first professional publication.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So, you know, the entire experience at Hunter wasn't perfect, but throughout her life, Audrey says that Hunter was the place that took her poetry from something that she did in private to something that she brought out into the world and that she was like really celebrated for. And it seems like that is something that is more attributed to the community that she built at Hunter, which was at the time an all-girls boarding school. Or not a boarding school, all-girls school. Sorry. Oh, we went to all-girls boarding school.
Yeah, we went.
My next note is literally relatable.
Relatable. Highly relatable.
So she talks about how she would like share it with her friends at like lunchtime and stuff like that. And this was just like a really important community of peers. Later in life, these friends would look back and call themselves the Branded, like as like a funny joke.
Yeah.
Which I think sounds badass. And everyone I heard talk about it was just like, that is so fucking cool. Like, what a name. What a name. Oh, her friends and her would do seances at lunchtime and share poetry and just genuinely uplift each other.
That's solid 10 out of 10 no notes. That's how you should be doing your teenage years.
Amazing. Perfect. So fun. Outside of school, she had a friend, Genevieve Johnson, Jenny, who had attended Hunter College but left her junior year because she wanted to focus more on dance rather than school and dance. They were best friends who spent all of their time together. When Jenny left the school, they would forge notes, like pretending to be each other's parents.
Oh.
So that they could like leave school and they would just like dress up and like do silly shit. Like they talked about wearing red bandanas on the subway and like being unionist and like singing the Internationale like unionist
song. Oh my God.
Just like dressing up in costumes and like going out and holding hands and eating ice cream and like cuddling and talking all the time.
Oh, history would call them best friends.
In her autobiography, Zammy, A New Spelling of My Name, Audrey called Jenny, quote, the first person that she was ever conscious of loving, end quote.
Oh my God.
A lot of this time was possible, like they were able to like ditch school and just spend all day at Jenny's house together because Jenny lived with her single mom. Oh. Jenny's dad had left them for another woman a while prior.
Yeah, that completely changes like the dynamic, you know?
Yeah.
I could see that.
So then Jenny's dad actually like reaches out to her and is like, hey, like let's reconnect. I want to be in your life.
Yeah.
I just like didn't want to be with your mom. The mom sees this as like a betrayal and not a good home life. And while with Audrey, Genevieve starts talking about her suicide as like something that is just impending. Like after I commit, is definitely going to happen. Her grandmother ends up finding her after a suicide attempt where she's taken to the hospital, not really knowing if there's anything else to do other than give Jenny anything she wants. She lets her go move in with her dad, but that doesn't change the issue. And Genevieve dies by suicide at 15.
No.
In her book, her autobiography, there's a list called Things I Never Did with Genevieve. Oh. And it is so beautiful and devastating.
Oh, I'm having a very visceral reaction to that right now.
Things I Never Did with Genevieve. Let our bodies touch and tell the passions that we felt. Go to a village gay bar or any bar anywhere. Smoke reefer. Derail the freight that took circus animals to Florida. Take a course in international obscenities. Learn Swahili. See Martha Graham's dance troupe. Visit Pearl Primus. Ask her to take us to Africa next time. Write the book, Make Love. End quote.
Oh.
You can take whatever you need to process this, dude.
Oh, I don't know why that hit me the way that it did. Sorry.
We all know someone who died by suicide, and I think it's very relatable to have this list. So to see not only the list exist within itself, but to see a gay woman expressing the things that she never got to do with someone that she clearly was in love with.
Yeah.
That clearly loved her back. It's multiple levels of heartbreak and beauty and sadness and realness.
Yeah.
This hits Audrey horribly. And there's no one that she can really grieve with. She's in high school in the 40s as a black girl who hasn't necessarily come to terms with her queerness and doesn't, they had never talked about it. They had, you know, nothing had ever been discussed. They
just existed.
They just existed. And then she lost that. So not only did she lose a person that she could just exist with, but who no one understands what she just lost. And that's something that she holds on to for the rest of her life and definitely impacted her a lot. She does graduate from high school in 1951 and takes this time to move out of her parents' house. Their relationship had always been complicated. They had a really good, she had a good childhood, but it was, you know, as she got older, things got complicated. I imagine the loss of Jenny and being unable to talk to her mom about why that was so important. I imagine that probably was a huge strain. And later in life, Audrey looks back with a lot more understanding and love for her parents and the things that they did, but it doesn't change the reality of the difficult times that they had. And for a while in her 20s, it seems like her and her mom were actually no contact for a while. She moves out after her and her sister get in a pretty big fight. And during this time, she had been seeing this guy, Jerry Levine, a white man who her parents did not approve of. And regardless of the fact that she was seeing him, she moved in with a friend and stayed on her couch until she was able to pay for her own room. While she's living on her friend's couch, she becomes a nurse's aide assistant and is also attending classes at Hunter College, which is a college, and had like a solid deal with Hunter High School, kind of like partnered there. Yeah. She didn't have any interest in working in the medical industry. Obviously, she's a poet. She's a writer. But this job was so important to the future that we know Audrey had. Now, she was a lesbian. She had not quite come to that. So she was seeing Jerry, as I mentioned. She says that, quote, sex with Jerry was dismal, frightening, and pretty demeaning, end quote. And that her friends told her that she would get used to it.
Oh, don't love that.
She did end up getting pregnant. And even though abortion was illegal, her connection to the medical industry through work got her set up with a nurse and a doctor who charged her $15 to get an abortion.
Wow.
She was pretty depressed afterwards, but never necessarily like connected the two, because many sources say, I think it was Queer as Fact, a podcast, said that like she was like really determined to not regret the abortion. So she didn't want to be like, I'm depressed because I had it. Yeah. But it's another situation where she's isolated. She's dealing with this alone and she doesn't really have anyone to talk to. So she's unable to get out of bed and she loses that job. Hunter College has support services, which most colleges do, by the way, take advantage. And they're able to get her a part-time job, which paid so much better, to the point where she was able to get her own apartment, and not like a shitty apartment. It had, okay, it was a big apartment. It had like a kitchen and a fireplace and a room. Like, it was big. It was really dirty and gross at first. But her and all of her friends, like the Branded, they all came in and kind of like cleaned it up and fixed it. Aww. And it was just kind of like their hub for them and all of their friends.
That's amazing. I love that.
And like most first apartments in New York City in the summer, it's hot as fuck. So you do what you gotta do when you're with your girls and you hang out in your underwear to stay comfortable.
You do what you gotta do.
You do what you gotta do. It was in this safe space of her own apartment, surrounded by her friends in their underwear, that she realized that this is like just like a fantasy, and that she's like, oh shit, I'm gay. Whoa. Which is super weird, because that's exactly what Taylor Swift said about hanging out with Victoria's Secret models. She was like, it's just like a fantasy. So that's interesting. She's going to classes during the day. She's like working her job that pays her great money. And she's coming home and hanging on her underwear with all of her friends while they drink brandy and just like have a great time.
Oh.
And for some reason, she starts not doing well in classes. No connection to not studying and staying up all night drinking brandy with your friends in your underwear. One point she was like, I just thought that there are certain people who like can't learn German, because she's like failing her German class. She's like not doing well, so she does end up dropping out of school for a little bit.
Okay.
And she's like chasing work like a lot of people, so she moves to Stamford, Connecticut, where she had been told that there was work. And instead of work that she had been doing, working as a medical assistant or a receptionist in a medical office, she experienced racism. And people gawked at the idea of a Black woman holding a position in a medical office. This led her to a factory job, where she was working with quartz and crystals, weighing them and sorting them and checking their charges for like watches and shit. You know, the like low levels of like radiations and like x-rays.
Yeah.
And stuff that are required to test crystals.
Yikes.
The way that it worked is like they would like go and like check in and like take a bunch of crystals and then like go and do their work. And that's how everything was tallied. And then you'd get bonuses for exceeding your quota.
Yeah, yeah.
And in order to make those bonuses, a lot of time people would skip safety measures, like putting up a partition between you and the x-ray machine.
Yeah.
Or licking the paintbrush for your watch, you know, like those sort of things. She, rather than just skipping safety measures, would also take a bunch of crystals and like hide them in her mouth or her socks or like wherever she could, so that she could dump them out on her break. But then she would be measured taking a bunch of crystals, which says that like she did a lot of work.
Yeah.
So she, was like exceeding her bonuses a lot.
Oh, good for her. Because like, yeah, defeat that capitalism. Absolutely. But also, I'm just so concerned about your health. I'm just so concerned about cancer.
Shit, I forgot you don't know that she dies of cancer.
Oh,
I forgot that everyone doesn't know that. Maybe take that part out, because then it'll be like,
yeah,
I don't know. Or take out what I said. But yes.
Okay.
Or actually, no, maybe we trigger, cancer. Yeah. You're not the first person to say that, actually, so keep all of that in. There are a lot of her friends and a lot of researchers and, like, documentarians who kind of, like, point to that time where they're like, is that what
was that caused
cancer?
Yeah.
The most important part of this factory job is that she meets Ginger. Virginia, what's up?
Ginger.
Ginger's 23 years old, and she's recently divorced from her husband.
Oh. God, that's so young.
That's so young.
I'm like, that's when yes. I met mine.
Married and divorced by 23.
Wow.
She is seated next to Audrey. Audrey takes this woman Marion's spot. Marion comes back into the story later because lesbians.
Okay.
So Audrey takes Marion's spot and she's chatting with Ginger. And Audrey's super stressed out on like one of her first days and just breaks down crying. And Ginger is like, that's relatable. So he takes her out for coffee. And a friendship blooms, which 100% evolves into sexual tension between the two of them.
Mm.
Ginger is older. So Audrey's like, okay, she's like older. She must know what she's doing. And Ginger's like, Audrey's from the city. She must know what she's doing.
Oh, what a conundrum.
What a conundrum. And it takes a little bit, but the two do get together. You can find a lot of information about their relationship, including the fact that Ginger's mom knew about them hooking up.
Okay.
And scolded them for spending all night having sex rather than sleeping because they have work the next day. But not for being gay.
Okay.
So cool. She's got a supportive spot. She's got a hot girl that she's hooking up with. And she's like really feeling herself. They have a mutual understanding. I don't know if they talked about it, but they both know, like, Audrey's like, I'm not staying here forever. And Ginger's like, I'm not looking for anything serious.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, what causes the split is Audrey's father has a stroke in 1953.
Oh.
So she goes home to New York to take care of her father and, like, kind of be with her family. And during this time, unfortunately, Frederick passes away. Because she was part of a union at the factory, the union is able to get her, like, a resignation with 2 weeks' pay rather than just, like, being outright fired. Support unions always. So she returns to New York with 2 weeks' pay, which is amazing. Now, setting the scene, Red Scare time.
Mm, okay.
Of course. Always finds its way into my episodes.
Yes, it does.
Audrey gets very involved in the activism of the way that the government is targeting individuals for being potential Soviet spies. She's like, this is bullshit.
Yeah. And she's right.
And she's right. Oh, she's so fucking right. But she's especially attached to the Rosenberg family.
Okay.
Do you know that off the top of your head? You might when I start describing it. It's a family who was accused of being spies, like, for the Soviet Union,
mm-hmm.
because of a tangential Russian thing. Maybe I'll do an episode on that one day. They get very involved in trying to stop the execution of this couple by the government for being Soviet spies.
Supposed, alleged. Oh my God.
One of the things that really stuck with Audrey, especially because she just lost her father, but also because, you know, Audrey has eyes and a soul, is the fact that these were two parents that the government would just, like, willingly create orphans. Like, she was really fucked up about that.
Yeah.
When the execution went through, she was like, fuck the U.S., I'm out. And as soon as she can, she leaves as the U.S. for Mexico City. She found herself in a community of radicals, not as scary as that sound, who had fled the U.S.
I feel like the United States itself has made that word seem crazier than it is. So, yeah.
100%. Big air quotes around radicals. A community of radicals, air quotes, who had fled the U.S. And she gets in touch with them through an American woman named Frida.
Okay.
And she's like, hey, what's up? We also left because we think that what the U.S. is doing is really fucked up. And we're here, we're hanging out, let's discuss, let's learn things. Well, being there and living there, she's also studying at the National University of Mexico, where she, quote, grew confident in her identity as both a lesbian and a poet, end quote. She's getting around.
Yeah.
And having a grand fucking time.
Good for her.
And you know what? Good for her. That's right. Go to Mexico, experience new types of education, new types of women. Do your fucking thing. I'm so here for all of this. She runs out of funds and is unable to get a job. So she's, like, kind of forced to move back to New York in 1954.
Okay.
And returns to Hunter College. this is where she's back in Hunter College. And she's like, hey, you know what? When I left, I was just like thinking about being gay and hanging out with my friends in their underwear. Now I'm back. I'm fucking gay. What's up, lesbian bar scene of New York? And we start seeing the foundation of where a lot of her later work and later writings about intersectionality come out. She notices that the lesbian bar scene is not segregated the way that the rest of the world is, but is very, like, in her opinion. She's not stoked with what she notices as a heteronormative expectation of the kind of, like, butch-femme dichotomy of the lesbian scene of the time. Like, you're a butch and you date a femme.
Yeah. I'm a femme and I like femmes.
She wasn't down with, like, the restrictions that were being placed on what she was hoping would be a more open community.
Okay.
There was also a lot of people who apparently would say things like, oh, like, even though I'm a white lesbian, I understand your oppression because, like, we're all black here.
No.
Sort of thing.
No.
They also wouldn't say black, but, like, it's not good.
Oh, no.
And Audrey's just kind of like...
No, you don't get to pretend to know somebody else's oppression.
Oh, and she always held the beliefs, like, that quote, I've always wanted to be both man and woman to encompass the strongest parts of both my mother and my father, end quote. For a while, she was also rejecting monogamy.
Okay.
Until our good friend Marion comes back into the picture.
Oh, okay.
So Ginger's like, hey, you're a poet and a lesbian, and I have this other friend, Marion, who's also a poet and a lesbian, and I think you guys should hang out.
Oh, okay.
She's also my ex. I think you guys should hang out.
Okay, Ginger. That's a real one.
That's real. That's the lesbian scene for you. It's wild. So, so much emotional maturity. And they get together, and they like, really fall in love. And both of them are like, oh, we're going to be, you're the love of my life, and we're going to be together forever. They're still very young.
Okay.
It's important to keep in mind. They move in together. Somewhere I read that they had two cats, two black cats, one named Crazy Lady and the other named Scary Lou.
Incredible.
Amazing.
Incredible names.
And, you know, they lived and loved. Audrey got her bachelor's degree in library science in 1959.
Nice.
She then went on to complete her master's degree in the same subject from Columbia University.
Ooh.
And went on to work at the New York Public Schools as a librarian for 7 years. She loved working with kids. She, of course, loved working for the black children in the neighborhood who would come to the library. It upset her deeply that there were not a lot of books geared towards black children. So she had her own personal collection that she would lend out to any kids who needed it. Her relationship with Marion ends. I don't have a ton of details on it, but it is, you know, it's a relationship that ends at 27. It sounds like growing has happened.
Yeah.
And it's also, they're at a point where her group of friends is, like, sort of the definition of, like, free love.
Yeah.
They're all very open. A few sources kind of said that the lines between, like, friendship and sexual attraction and love, like, definitely got blurred. They're just, like, a group of people who are all kind of having sex with each other.
That sounds good to me.
And this included a cape-wearing gay man named Ed.
Oh!
But, like, he was gay and she was a lesbian, but they still had sex together, even though...
Yeah, I think that's they're doing a their lot thing. More common than some people think.
Probably. He proposes, and she's like, okay, let me think about it. And she goes to, like, talk to her friends, and he goes to, like, talk to his people, and everyone they go and talk to is like, that's the worst fucking idea I've ever heard.
Oh my god.
Like, what Tell are you doing? Do. And the two of them were like, fuck you, well, I think it's a great idea, and so does Ed. So they do it.
Okay. I just love that
Almost
energy.
Like the opposition of, like, people being against them brought them closer together. Like, no, fuck you, we're gonna do it. And they both wanted children. Children in a marriage is, like, very important at this time in the world. So they're like, all right, let's let's go for this. It's also, you know, we can't pretend that the idea of like existing as an openly gay black woman in like 1962, that like that's safe, because it's not. Yeah. Like, it's not a safe time for either of them.
Well, it almost feels like bearding for one another, but with a deeper connection.
It does appear that way. Because she's like, she writes in her journals and stuff that she's like, she likes him. She loves him. She cares about him.
Yeah.
So they get married and they do have two children together. It's 1962 where she publishes a poetry collection, The First Cities, which showcase kind of her early exploration of identity and place. And one of like the most known quotes from that is, "I am woman and not white." Just like a powerful reclamation of her blackness, which is not often seen in published poetry at the time. In this marriage, they were both like very open about their sexuality and how they're going to have sex with other people. Regardless of that, they have a daughter and a son, Elizabeth and Jonathan. 1963 brings turmoil for the world. It's the civil rights movement. It's the March on Washington. March on Washington.
For a moment, I was like, did I hear that wrong?
Nope. It took me a second also. This is a important time of reclaiming your rights and identity, and Audrey is involved in the March on Washington. As she is exploring this avenue and this part of her identity, the marriage is not going great. Ed is standoffish in the sense that, like, he likes to have anonymous sex, and he's not, like, sharing all of that with Audrey.
Okay.
And she's not, like, she's like, oh, tell me about this person that you're seeing, the way that she is used to in her previous relationships and
hookups.
And that's just, like, not what he's about. He's like, I just had anonymous sex with this hot dude. Like, what more do you want? And she really judges him for that and says that he's only doing that, not to him, but to herself, is really thinking that he's only doing that because he's, like, ashamed of his sexuality and stuff. And it's like, now people can be turned on by anonymous sex, girl. Like, that could be his thing. But it's just not going well. Yeah. So we start to see some cracks in their relationship, and we're seeing that this isn't working out the way that she kind of hoped that it would. They're also living very gendered lives. Yeah. The very gendered lives that they kind of wanted to avoid. You know, they have kids and she's staying home with them, and he's a lawyer, he's the breadwinner, and it's just kind of like, this is exactly what they were trying to avoid, but they found themselves in this. In 1968, she releases Cables to Rage, which dives really deep into themes of racism, love, and womanhood. My favorite quote is, quote, "Poetry is the way we help give name to the nameless so it can be thought," end quote. It's reviewed by major publishing houses as a quiet and introspective book, but because it is a very introspective book. Momentum grows from this major publishing house's acknowledging and uplifting something written by a black woman in the 60s. She's getting a lot of attention. Momentum is growing. And she's invited to run a poetry workshop at Tougaloo College in Mississippi. And she's nervous about going south as a black woman. She's really nervous about that. Ed really supports her and is like, no, like, this is big. Like, you should really do this. Like, take this opportunity. So she does. She fucking thrives in this 6-week teaching experience. She falls in love with teaching, understanding that teaching and activism and poetry for her are, like, intrinsically linked.
Oh, I love that.
She creates in this workshop, which ends up only being 10 students, 9 of which are black, the last one was a white girl, creates a safe place for these students to discuss race and what she referred to as her theory of difference, the idea that we are stronger because we're different and we cannot continue separating us into smaller and smaller groups because, like, dividing us is how we are overpowered.
I kind of love that it was a small group of students where she got to, like, do this first experience into teaching, because that feels like such a much more intimate and, like you said, safe space to be able to, like, really have deep connection and communication and reach people on, like, a very spiritual level, I think. That's really beautiful.
It's incredibly beautiful. And this is at the same time during as the Black Power movement. Yeah. And she obviously supports the Black community and finding power in your Blackness. But she also found herself a little bit against some of her students who were very much so behind Black Power, Black Power. And she was like, hey, we need to include other minorities in this. And that's where her theory of difference comes in. She's like, together, all of us will be stronger. We can't forget about the other people who are also being scrutinized and attacked by the people in power. And that was a huge eye-opening experience for everyone in that class.
There's no liberation for any of us if there's not liberation for all. And it's beautiful to see that happening, that she could have those discussions with her students. Wow.
I've obsessed with Audre Lorde. She's so a genius. And I credit her to helping me as a piece of shit 18 and 19 year old in college understand the Black Lives Matter movement as it began. I was not on the right side of things when that first started. I did not understand what was going on when I was 18 and 19. And it's because of the classes that I took in college that introduced me to critical race theory, Audre Lorde, and other incredible Black writers, that I was able to step outside myself for a second and be introduced to something that turned me into who I am now. I don't know what the fuck Goose is going crazy about, but it's driving me nuts. I want to close the door, but Beetlejuice isn't in here, so I can't block him off from the fucking litter boxes. Of course, teaching this poet in residence at Tougaloo was huge for her for that experience. In another way, it was huge because she met Francis Clayton, who would turn out to be her longtime partner. Francis was a visiting professor as well of psychology, a 41-year-old white woman. And when Audre left, she, quote, knew two things. Her relationship with Ed was not enough, and that Frances would be a permanent person in her life, end quote. So she comes back to the library, and she's like, after what I just did, this is not enough anymore. She ends her marriage. I mean, she seeks counseling. It's more than that. She tries, but they separate. For a long time, blaming it entirely on Ed, but later in life acknowledges that she played a part in that not going well. I think she says, like, maybe perhaps I am too stubborn. It's like, yeah, it's okay.
Relatable.
Yeah. They separated, but did remain friends. They had kids. She, so inspired by her time at Tougaloo, goes to John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Ooh. And is like, what's up? I would like to teach a course about racism and urban race issues. Are you interested?
What a power move.
Guys, it is the 1960s. And she walks into a college that used to be like for police only, but had recently opened up to the public and was like, I want to teach a class about racism and urban race issues to police officers. And she got the fucking job.
Amazing.
Her class breakdown would be like cops and then other people who hadn't prior had access to education like this. Yeah. A lot of times it would be minorities, other people of color. And she taught that job for like the next few decades of her life.
Wow.
In 1971, her and Francis move in together, and they are like the main carers for the two children, Elizabeth, Beth, and Jonathan. In 1973, her next book is published. It's called From a Land Where Other People Live. And the whole thing is on confronting societal norms and advocating for marginalized voices. My favorite quote is, "Your silence will not protect you." In this book, she wanted to include a poem where it's like full-on erotic poem about her having sex with a woman.
I love that.
And her publishers were like, we can't do bitches. This. So she takes it out because she's more focused on getting the book out than she is on being publicly out as a lesbian. And she's nominated for a National Book Award for poetry alongside some men and two other women.
Amazing.
In natural female fashion, the three women get together and draft a statement together because they're very much so like, if any of us win, this is fucking huge.
God, I love women. I love women.
Yeah, women are the fucking best. She doesn't end up winning that award, but the other woman that does brings her on stage with her and reads the speech that they wrote together. Regardless, that same year at a poetry reading, she reads her sexy poem and comes out publicly, has it published in a magazine, and then again publishes it in her next book.
Yes.
A quote from that is not from the sexy poem, but just from New York Head Shop and Museum. We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid in the same way we have learned to speak when we are tired. Which I think is really powerful. In 1975, they take a trip to the west coast of Africa, which is something that Audrey had been dreaming about for a long time. She had romanticized the idea of going to Africa, and while she was there, was like really uncomfortable with how American she felt, and was pretty deeply upset with the power that Francis's whiteness still held, even in Africa.
Yeah.
People would refer to Francis before Audrey, and like that was upsetting. Regardless, she found a lot of connections through food, proverbs, and really felt connected to the indigenous religion because it encompassed ideas of spiritual unity between the genders. She was like, yes, I fucking love that.
Hell yeah.
There was also a local deity, which was like a one-breasted woman that she found a lot of power in. She comes back from Africa and her, as sources said, book is published by a mainstream publishing house, Reed White owned publishing house. And because of that, she's now being recognized outside of the black circles that she is famous in.
Okay.
She publishes Coal, which is a critically acclaimed collection, poems addressing themes of oppression, identity, and resilience. One of the most famous quotes from it is, quote, "When I dare to be powerful, to use my strength in the service of my vision, then it becomes less and less important whether I am afraid," end quote.
Wow.
Colleges around the world and the U.S. start asking her to come speak to them about her poetry, activism, civil rights movements around the world she becomes involved in. She also becomes highly aware of the phrase of women of color versus black. When traveling outside of the world, she meets people who identify either as black and don't like the term women of color or reject certain terms. And it really takes what she had been looking at as a black issue as a larger issue of women of color and minorities around the world. And she really credits that time period to giving her a worldly view mm-hmm. of intersectionality. It zoomed things out for her.
Yeah.
In a way that she was like very, very thankful for. In November of 77, she finds a tumor on one of her breasts. And even though it is benign, she does find another one 10 months later that is cancerous, and she gets a mastectomy. She refuses to use a prosthesis, finding a lot of strength in the local one-breasted deity that she had found a lot of connection in before. And at this time, she also publishes the Cancer Journals, a powerful memoir addressing the issues of illness, body image, and healing. Lord becomes an advocate for cancer patients, particularly women of color, by challenging conventional medical practices and advocating for holistic approaches to health and well-being. During all of this, she's still participating in protests, marches, demonstrations, advocating for racial equality, LGBTQ+ rights, and women's rights. Every part of her life, her activism was intersectional, recognizing the interconnectedness of various forms of oppression and emphasizing the importance of addressing overlapping systems of discrimination based on race, class, gender, and sexuality. Her and Francis were together for an incredibly long time, but it kind of got to the point where they had been together for too long and grew apart.
Yeah.
So by the early 80s, their partnership was crumbling and Audrey put herself into other tasks. Her and Francis's relationship did eventually end officially in 88. So I'm not necessarily going to be talking about that anymore, but just a little detail. In 1980, she co-founded Kitchen Table, which was Women of Color Press, a groundbreaking publishing collective amplifying the voices of women of color. And it was established by her, Barbara Smith, Cherie Moraga, and Hattie Gossett as a pioneering feminist publishing collective. Their mission was like dedicated to amplifying the voices and experiences of women of color and providing a platform for marginalized narratives often overlooked by mainstream publishers. Their publishing philosophy was being committed to producing works that challenged traditional power structures, explored intersectional identities, and promoted social justice and equality. Guys, this was 1980. 1980. Unfortunately, it ceased operations in the late 80s. They remain a symbol of grassroots activism and solidarity and inspired generations of publishers, writers, and activists to center marginalized voices in the fight for social change. Like, we know to do that because these women fucking did it.
I'm so blown away. I'm like so emotional on the other side of this call right now.
1982 is when she releases Zammy, A New Spelling of My Name, her memoir exploring her Caribbean heritage, her sexuality, and her coming of age journey. You know, I pulled a quote. I have come to believe over and over again that what is most important to me must be spoken, made verbal, and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood. End quote.
Ugh, damn.
I told you that you should read her autobiography.
I'm going to. Shit.
I'm literally doing this episode specifically for you. I'm not joking.
I'm having a very emotional reaction to learning about this incredible human.
In 1983, the U.S. invaded Grenada, which is her ancestral land that she hadn't really gotten the chance to explore the way that she wanted to. This emotionally devastated her in a way that is difficult even to, for which I'll never understand. As a white woman whose family did the colonize, I'll never understand what that's like. And she was devastated by it. In 1984, she published Sister Outsider, which was another collection of essays and speeches that have become a seminal piece of work in feminist and queer theory. A lot of Tumblr quotes, a lot of that comes from Sister Outsider. It brings together a diverse range of her writings covering racism, sexism, homophobia, classism, and almost all of the intersections of identity. She critiques dominant power structures and challenges the status quo, advocating for the empowerment and liberation of marginalized communities. She interrogates the ways in which language, culture, and societal norms perpetuate oppression and marginalization, because she had seen this everywhere she looked. Every community that she sought to find something in, she was like, oh, there's still a weird power dynamic here. You know, she had created her relationship with Ed and they still found themselves in gender roles. She published her book and still found them saying, no, you need to take this poem out. She went to Africa and she still found them prioritizing her partner's whiteness. I fucking love her. Unfortunately, this is the same year that they find a tumor on her liver in 1988. They believe that it must have metastasized from her previous form of cancer, and unfortunately, it's incurable. She releases A Burst of Light, a collection of essays reflecting on her battle with cancer, activism, and the human condition. Quote, I am deliberate and afraid of nothing. End quote. She passes away on November 17th of 1992 in the U.S. Virgin Islands, leaving behind a massive, rich literary legacy and a profound impact on the entire social justice movement of the world. Many activists, writers, and incredible people look to Audrey and credit her for what they have come to do within the movement. And I highly, highly recognize to pick up anything you can find with her name on it, because she is amazing. And that's my episode.
You just made me fall in love with someone that I'll never be able to meet.
I'm sorry. I thought about making this multiple parts. There's so much more. There's so much more.
What an incredibly complex and beautiful human being.
Oh, she was amazing.
Katie, thank you so much for this absolutely incredible episode. Holy shit.
Of course. Absolutely. Of course. I will have many more episodes like this a-coming. One of the reasons I wanted to get ahead is because it makes it easier for me to do notes. So I have four other just amazing overlooked Black women that I want to talk about.
Okay. So. I'm excited. Ah, all right. I can't handle anymore, so... We'll see you guys next week.
Bye. Bye.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.